Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So before the break, we heard a great conversation about the latest in the Massachusetts charter school debate.
And as we said, it's a debate that's been around for a number of years.
Which is part of what makes any discussion about ed reform sometimes frustrating.
Because they can feel repetitive. And because they're repetitive, it feels as if we haven't made much progress in really defining what education should be for the 21st century.
I mean, part of the problem is that everyone has a favorite villain in this fight. Some people say charter schools are the problem. No, others say teachers' unions are the villain. No, still others say it's standardized tests and the Common Core. No, wait. Yet another group says it's lack of money, parents who don't care, billionaires who care too much, lazy students, globalization, rising China, college tuition costs, et cetera.
But step back for a moment and think about this. If fingers are being pointed in every direction when it comes to ed reform, if we zoom out from our perspective, maybe there's something fundamentally wrong with the entire system itself. Maybe we ought to completely rethink why we educate our kids in the first place.
Well, that audacious idea is where the new documentary Most Likely to Succeed begins. It was screened last night at Hub Week and will also screen at the Future of Schools Tour in Providence, Rhode Island today and on October 14th at UMass Boston. Ted Dintersmith is the executive producer of Most Likely to Succeed, and he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me. I love your show.
It's great to have you. Also with us today, Jesse Solomon. He's executive director of the Boston Plan for Excellence, and he founded the Boston Teacher Residency Program, and he's also taught both in public and charter schools for a decade. Jesse Solomon, welcome to you.
Thanks for having
me. We're
going
to use you as our man on the ground for our reality check and experience here, because Ted Dintersmith, I watched Most Likely to Succeed today. It's an incredible film, and it starts out with this premise that basically in 2015, we are using a model of education that dates back to when?
1893,
and
125
why?
Years ago.
Why?
I think it's just rolled forward and it's become systematized. And so we continue to push on the same model, which was a model developed with a lot of foresight at the time, but a model to prepare kids for a world of assembly line jobs. The world has changed, but schools look exactly the same. And the way we've chosen to try to address the issue is to do what we've always done more intensely, instead of stepping back and saying, what could we do quite differently?
Okay, so let's put this another way. So a model of education that worked in the Industrial Revolution is what we're still using in the age of the Information Revolution. I mean, there's a funny Massachusetts connection here, right? Because it was Horace Mann himself who went over to Europe, to Prussia specifically, and brought over the Prussian model of education to the United States and sold it to Ford, Carnegie, Vanderbilt, and J.P. Morgan and said, this is how you're going to educate a workforce for the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
And we use that today.
And we did. And it was actually incredibly successful. We prepared millions of young Americans for jobs that were surging, growing rapidly. We created a middle class. But when you look at their design criteria, you know, do routine tasks over and over, don't be creative, don't get bored, follow instructions.
And so on. So I want to play a couple of clips from the movie Most Likely to Succeed about why this matters today, because you have some very eloquent speakers on this. First, you spoke with the movie features some thoughts from Kenneth Robinson. He's an author, a speaker, and an advisor on education. He also happens to have the single most watched TED Talk in the history of TED Talks about education. And here's how he describes essentially what he calls the factory model of education that students go through today.
We divide the day up in high schools into bits of time, you know, into 40 or 50 minute blocks typically, and then we ring bells and people start to shuffle around the building and do something else. That's an organizational device. It's not an educational principle. And it is, in broad sweeps, a system that resembles a factory culture.
But we don't live in a factory economy anymore. So Andrew McAfee is also featured in the documentary, and he is at MIT along with Eric Brynjolfsson, who've written about the fact that information is really changing even how the middle class lives and works. And here's how he says why the current day economy doesn't match our model of education.
The economy that we created over the course of the 20th century was an economy that needed a large number of moderately skilled people who could do the three R's and who could follow pretty simple instructions. As we head deeper into the 21st century, I really don't think that's the case anymore, yet our educational system still seems to be focused on turning out people with that same relatively small set of skills. My fear is that they're heading into a society and an economy and a workforce that doesn't value those skills very much anymore.
That's Andrew McAfee, featured in the new documentary Most Likely to Succeed. Jesse Solomon, let me get, again, a reality check from you here. Does that disconnect that Andrew McAfee is describing, do you feel that disconnect in classrooms today?
Yeah. I mean, I guess one thing I would add to start is we're trying to do something now as an educational system that we've never tried to do, which is to actually educate all kids. And so we, in addition to being an outdated model, it's not a model that was intended to educate everybody. And we probably, at best, are educating kids for the kinds of standards and competencies of, say, 1995 or 2005, but not 2015 and certainly not 2025. And so the question is, what's the world that these kids are going to enter, and how do we create experiences and schools that look more like that world that they're going to enter and less like the world that was that they've left behind?
So this is a question that's in every classroom then today, every day. So give me an example of like how teachers are grappling with that.
So I think one of the ways that teachers are grappling with that is trying to figure out, so I'll give you an example from the school that we're involved in, the Dearborn School that our organization now manages. And so 11th graders in the school are engaged in an engineering class. And so next week they're meeting with the architect who's designing the new building that the school will inherit in a couple of years, and learning from the architect and from his firm about what goes into the design process, what the politics look like, what are the considerations around energy, et cetera. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to take concepts that might exist in a textbook or on a set of standards and make them real by creating connections to the world around them.
Ted Dintersmith, you're shaking your head yes.
Yeah, that sounds like, I haven't visited it, but it sounds like a great program. But I think what I found across all sorts of states, and I'm going to all of them, is that when kids are learning by doing instead of learning by memorizing, they're engaged, they retain what they learn, and they're capable of producing amazing things.
Mm-hmm. Well, so today I want to kind of rejigger the Radio Boston studio, and we'll call it the Radio Boston Ed Lab. Okay, so listeners, we're asking this big question. If indeed the model of education we follow today, more or less in 2015, was one that was revolutionary in the 1890s, what would a modern day education revolution look like today? If you could rebuild a classroom from the ground up, what would it be? How would you teach? Who would you teach? And what would the subjects be? Would we continue to follow the factory model as we talked about before, or would we have something else completely different? If Horace Mann, as we learn in the documentary Most Likely to Succeed, brought back a Prussian model that prized fitness, organization, and obedience, we'll get to the obedience thing in a minute, what are the three values that you think should be rock solid at the heart of education today? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Ted Dintersmith, in your movie Most Likely to Succeed, a lot of the story unfolds at one particular high school in San Diego called High Tech High. It's quite different than anything I've ever seen before. Can you give us a brief description about what's happening there?
Well, the school appealed to my team. They started at 12 schools. They've zeroed in on that because they wanted to tell a story, but it doesn't look like a school anybody who watches a film is familiar with. And what we wanted to do is show that school could be quite different, but at the same time, kids are really learning important things. And so we immerse the audience in these two students, in their teachers, and you see them take on these big, ambitious challenges and just go after them.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, a lot of what they do sounds a lot like what Jesse was telling us earlier, interdisciplinary projects that are largely student-led and try to connect to the real world. But it's also the tone of teaching that I found to be quite different. So let's play a little bit of the film here. This is, again, from the documentary Most Likely to Succeed. And you're going to hear the voice of a student at High Tech High. Her name's Elena. And it's during a seminar class, and she talks about what she didn't like about her earlier school experience. She's a ninth grader. And here, she basically says it was boring, and her humanity teacher then pushes her further, and here's what he says.
Define boring.
It's hard to explain.
Anybody help her? Okay. Try to imagine that we're going to get to a point where I'm not going to be here. I'm going to be sitting over there. It's a beautiful thing. Have a 30, 45-minute conversation with no adult. It's wonderful.
That's a scene from the documentary Most Likely to Succeed. Jesse Solomon, what really took me in that scene was there's actually quite a lot of silence. I mean, first of all, the teacher, it's a Socratic method, for lack of a better term. He asks her, like, define what you actually mean. And she struggles to think about it. But then he says, really, the goal is for me to not even be here as a teacher. Is that too revolutionary?
I don't think it's too revolutionary. I think one thing that good teachers and good teaching and good schools have in common is they transfer the intellectual heavy lifting to the students as much as possible. So it's not so much the literal removal of the teacher. It's the notion of, are we doing intellectually rigorous work? And the answer needs to be yes. And who's actually doing that work? And the answer has to be the students.
Mm. Now, Ted Dintersmith, in another interview I read, the person asked you that you said that a lot of what's in the film, specifically featured at High Tech High, you weren't sure if it would be likely to find its way to other schools. Why is that?
Well, you asked earlier about the emerging new model, and my answer is it needs to be the emerging new models. And we need to take advantage of the strengths of teachers and the interests and goals of students and the way they learn. And so the film's quite explicit. This is how they do it with their community and their strengths, and we encourage other schools not to copy it, but to think hard about their way of doing it in a way that students are engaged and inspired, as are their teachers.
Mm. Well, at High Tech High, for example, they have these interdisciplinary classes, and there's one of them that the film follows throughout the year where they have to come up with theories about why civilizations rise and fall. And then in their physics class, and I put that in double quotes because it's not actually a separate class, they have to build a physical model that simulates the rise and fall of a civilization. But they don't get tested any time throughout the year on anything that they're learning. What they have at the end of the year is exhibition night. My question, and Jesse, let me throw this to you. There is someone in the film who says, kids never ask, why am I learning this? Because it seems self-evident to them. They know. But in situations like that, how do kids know why they're learning it, if indeed there isn't a fixed end goal that we commonly recognize as a test?
I'm not sure that kids often do know why they're doing the things we ask them to do across a variety of settings, and that probably crosses school models and pedagogical models. But I wouldn't also take the sort of other counter to that, which is that when there's a test at the end, they know why they're learning it. I was a math teacher for 10 years, and yes, I gave tests, and the number of times I had students say to me, why are we learning this, as probably many people in the audience have also asked, is too many to count. So I think what you hope for in those cases is less of this clarity necessarily about where it's going, but more of this notion of flow. I think what you see in the movie is kids getting into the work for the sake of the work. It is authentic and compelling work because of the sake of the work, and I think that transfers down the line.
Okay, so now's the time for a little bit of pushback, because in the film itself, there's some very eloquent people who say that they're not quite sure about this new model, whatever the new model might be of education. And some of the most eloquent pushback, I have to say, comes from parents who are sending their kids to High Tech High, this sort of new model school. So we've got a clip here. And there's a teacher who's talking to a concerned parent because she's worried about what her child is learning and whether he's actually learning enough. And then the teacher comes back and says, hey, look, I went to Berkeley. I had a very traditional education. I studied math and then, you know, I worked really hard and I jumped through all the hoops. And then the teacher says this.
And then I went into banking. I worked for an asset management firm, and I felt like I was not truly prepared to work in a team environment, to take on tasks that were very arbitrary and open-ended. I didn't know how to ask necessarily the best questions. And I think that there was a lot of things that I just didn't learn in college that I think these kids are actually learning now.
You knew all of the math in order to take those tests and get into Berkeley,
yeah.
and then continue in math at Berkeley. And so I'm thinking, even though you're not learning the skills, the social skills and the teamworking skills that you learned once you got into the workplace,
mm-hmm.
part of the back of my head is thinking, well, you would have never made it to that workplace if you didn't jump through the hoops to get there.
That's a scene from Most Likely to Succeed. Ted Dintersmith, this actually was one of the scenes that really stopped me in my tracks, because I think the mom really is honest about her concerns. If we're talking about the entire system of education, one that we said earlier dates back to the 1890s and needs a 2015 reboot, the entire system includes the endpoint, college or a job. And if the current incentives that those endpoints provide aren't the ones that innovative education models, you know, aren't the ones that we would get from innovative education models, like what's the point? I mean, she's basically saying, hey, yeah, you can teach my kid to be a free thinker, but you went to Berkeley and you got a job first, the traditional way.
Well, there are two points I'd make about that. I think the film is very honest about the dilemma of parents and families. And so do you play the game or do you modify and do something quite different? And you see that. They agonize over it. The point that it also makes is that college is no longer the guarantee. 53% of kids in America today, recent college graduates, are unemployed or underemployed. And so it used to be college was close to free and almost certainly a guarantee of a good job. Those ground rules have changed entirely, and I think that begs for a lot of thought and evaluation on everybody's behalf.
Okay, but Jesse Solomon, let me ask you. Still, for a lot, not everybody wants to go to college, but a lot of students do, and the gatekeepers for those colleges are still looking for tests and standards by which we still currently measure students.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a yes and, right? Not a but. I think good schools do both, right? And you can't sort of just favor one side and not deal with the other side. And I would say that's especially true, you know, in places like Boston, where you have students often in a class. And I taught, say, math. I had ninth grade kids in an algebra class who had missed some skills along the way, and so maybe were missing some fifth grade math skills, right? And so it was my job to ensure, in addition to the fact that they had to do interesting open-ended problems, they also had to learn the math skills that they needed that supported the doing of the interesting problems and helped them do well on tests. They need to do both those things. And I think good schools don't separate those two things and say one of the other good schools try to do both.
That sounds really tough, though, because yeah. A lot of people say that the two are that they're not, that they actually are mutually exclusive. I mean, that's at the core of some of the debate here, that being able to do well on the test is the antithesis of actually lifelong learning skills.
Yeah. So I disagree. I mean, I think any of us, any of us who have kids disagree for our own kids. I don't know any parents who say we only want one of these and not the other. So I think we're thinking about that as parents, and I think some communities are thinking about that. But I think that is you put your finger on it. It is incredibly hard. And we have not currently structured schools or the teaching profession to allow us to successfully do that for kids kind of at scale.
Ted Dintersmith, did you want to jump in here?
Sure. There's an anecdote in the film about Lawrenceville Academy where kids study hard, do really well on tests. 3 months later, they've essentially forgot everything. And I think the balance there is the kids at High Tech High, I was back there 2 months ago, they remember every detail of those civilizations. So the point I think it's important to make is if a kid really cares about it, they'll internalize it.
Okay, so there's so much more we could talk about just this issue, but we have a lot of people who want to join us in this conversation. Again, we're revamping education for the 21st century in today's Radio Boston Ed Lab version. So let's go to our callers. Ilana is calling from Newton. You're on the air, Ilana.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
What's your thought?
So I am a sixth grade math teacher in the public school system, and I would love to see our educational system change in some of these major ways. I feel a little bit torn, though, because I feel like it has to, in some respects, happen from the top down. As a sixth grade math teacher, I feel like I'm preparing students for seventh and eighth grade, and I know those teachers feel like they're preparing students for what's going to be demanded of them in high school, and high school teachers feel like they're preparing students for what's expected and all of the requirements to get into colleges. And so my question is, where do we start, and how do we start making change when each, you know, teacher every step of the way feels like what they are doing, you know, is they're expected to be preparing students for what comes next?
Alana, thank you so much for your call. Ted Dintersmith, do you have a response for her?
It's indisputable. The college admissions process drives behavior in lots and lots of schools across America. The question I raise is, as we prepare kids for these hoops, are we preparing them for life? And I think that's where we're falling down. Also, on the top down, we had a screening in Boston last night with Jim Pizer, Secretary of Education for Massachusetts. And that's what I'm doing with the film, is trying to get to the people at the highest levels that can actually start to implement bolder changes to move things forward in a way that is more authentic.
Let's take another call. Robert is calling from Taunton. You're on the air, Robert.
Oh, yes. Hello. Thank you. To say that applying one basic principle of education in a society now that we have schools where there could be 25 or 50 different languages, and how many cultures does that denote? That's mind-boggling to me. And then also, too, you know, 1890, you had a much different society where the young people were growing up in families who didn't have automation. They had to fend for themselves, growing their own food, cutting their wood. That was a lifelong learning process for them, being having to sustain their own lives, whereas now there's very little that's taught at the home. You ask a kid where, you know, a pineapple comes from. Does it grow on a tree or a bush? I mean, so there's a lot that's missing, I think,
right,
in our culture.
Robert, thank you so much for your call. Jesse Solomon, let me ask you to respond to what Robert said about just the sheer fact of the diversity of students in classrooms.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, it makes the job fun and interesting. And I don't think Robert was saying this, but I guess my response would be that we've developed a bit of a culture in schools and education sometimes where we almost shield the school and what happens in the school from the communities and families that students come from. And I think the key here is to think about those students and those families as an incredible asset, and to create partnerships and draw on those strengths.
I want to play another clip from the movie Most Likely to Succeed here, and it gets back to what expectations are in 21st century education. Because I think, again, some of the strongest pushback to this idea that we can really, really revolutionize how and what we teach actually came from students in school today. Because there's a scene from Castleview High School in Colorado where students of a particularly innovative math teacher were asked whether or not that teacher's job was to train them to ace tests or to be able to apply mathematics in daily life and their jobs later on. And here's what the students said.
Do you want Jim and Vince to train you guys to ace tests? Or would you rather Jim and Vince train you to be able to kind of apply stuff like this in your daily life or in your job later?
For me, it's...
Please do.
I want to ace the test. So I get to college, that's how I get a job. Like, I feel like this, like, stuff in college, you focus on what you want to do with your life and, like, in the real world. And so I feel like that's when you should focus on that, because not everyone's going to go off and do math. So I feel like I would rather ace the test. That's just a personal opinion of mine.
I agree with that.
That's a scene from Most Likely to Succeed. Ted Dintersmith, the movie also says that, okay, so that's a classical type of education a student was reacting to. When we were talking about High Tech High, the film said that the jury's still out. There isn't yet enough data to know if these new models of education are actually any better. So, you know, so what do we do with that?
Well, the Denver scene, the Castleview, I love that because that's where the blood drains out of the face of parents. And when they see kids that have had all sense of purpose in their life drained out over a school process and are still, you know, focused on jumping through hoops. On the data front, I feel like the film team did a great job of not pushing an answer down people's throats, but saying these are options, these are trade-offs. I mean, they've actually gone from one school to 12. People have come from all over the world to visit there. There's a lot of evidence that says this is a really interesting model, but I think we were we really wanted to say, make up your own mind and innovate and create in your own way instead of copy.
Hmm. You know, interestingly, earlier I asked listeners about what they think the three core values of education should be. Suzanne W. Bossert sent me a tweet saying, collaboration, curiosity, and integration. That's what she says. Jesse Solomon, I'm going to throw actually the last question to you, because at the end of Most Likely to Succeed, the filmmakers list a lot of schools that they visited across the country and said that one unifying theme that they saw in places that were trying new things was that students and teachers had a sense of purpose. But they also said they saw it in a lot of places. So is this revolution happening anyway as we speak, that we don't need, you know, the Bill Gates or the Mark Zuckerbergs or even the Ted Dintersmiths of the world, you know, the captains of industry today to tell us how to reform education?
We do need the Ted Dintersmiths. I just want to say it that first.
Thank you.
If this is a revolution, it is an extremely slow revolution. So it's less about who we need. I actually think we need more people all thinking about this together if we're going to get there in our lifetimes.
Well, Jesse Solomon is Executive Director of the Boston Plan for Excellence. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Ted Dintersmith, Executive Producer of the documentary Most Likely to Succeed and Partner Emeritus at Charles River Ventures. Ted, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And listeners, there's a lot more information about Most Likely to Succeed at our website, radioboston.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.